Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum, and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ed Larson. I'll introduce Ed Larson, Professor Ed Larson. But you can keep standing here, please. Okay, Ed Larson is currently teaching at Stanford University as a visiting professor of law. He is university professor of history and holds the Darling Chair in Law at Pepperdine University. A graduate with Williams College and Harvard Law School, and holder of a PhD in the history of science from the University of Wisconsin, Ed has written 10 books and published over 60 articles, mostly matters of science, history, and exploration. His book on the Scopes Trial, Summer for the Gods, received the 1998 Pulitzer Prize in History. Ed's article has appeared in such diverse journals as Science, Nature, Scientific American, American History, Wilson Quarterly, Wall Street Journal, Time, and The Atlantic Monthly. An award-winning teacher, Ed has lectured widely at universities, natural history museums, and scientific societies. He has appeared on NOVA, American Experience, Book Notes, The Daily Show, The History Channel, The Today Show, and other broadcasts. His course on the history of theory of evolution is available through the teaching company. Ed's presentation today is based on his most recent book, An Empire of Ice, in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of Robert Falcon Scott reaching the South Pole. Please join me in welcoming Ed Larson.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that kind invitation, and thank you for having me in this wonderful venue and this wonderful city. I'm delighted to be here. It's truly an honor. As was suggested, 100 years ago, last month, in December of 1911, as commemorated, if you can have very good eyesight on this sign that's at the South Pole, a five-man Norwegian team led by Roald Amundsen became the first to reach the South Pole, what was then known, considered the last grand destination in the world. Now, 100 years ago this week, on January 19, 1912, a similarly sized British band under the command of Robert Falcon Scott reached the same place, only to find that the Norwegians had gotten there first. Now, this is a picture of Amundsen. I picked this particular picture because this is how he envisioned himself, or at least wanted others to envision him, because this is the picture that he put in the frontispiece of his book about going to the South Pole. These aren't, they don't, that he's wearing his Inuit clothing. They don't have Inuits in Antarctica. He had earlier become famous for being the first to make it through the Northwest Passage, an easy sail today thanks to global warming, but then the first time anyone had ever done it, and it took him 3 years, two winters, and he got to know the Inuits when he was up there, and Inuit clothing, and so this is how he pictured himself as the great adventurer and explorer. Now, as I say, Scott and his team reached 5 weeks later, January 19th, and here is how he pictured himself. This was on his first book, so this is how he pictured himself. You can probably see why he failed. That's how he wanted others to envision him. Well, the losers in this supposed race to the South Pole never returned. Over time and countless retellings, it became an epic tale of adventure, competition, triumph, and tragedy in a frozen land. Now, given the drama of the British Death March and the remarkable efficiency of the Norwegian effort and the worldwide attention focused on the supposed race between these two parties, I'm not surprised that historians and popularizers alike have tended to focus the narrative of these expeditions on the quest for the pole. But I wasn't invited here by the exploration division of the Commonwealth Society. I was invited here by the science division, and there's a reason for that. I'm a historian of science, and I'm drawn to science. Researchers on Scott's two expeditions, there weren't one, there were two. This was the frontispiece on his first one. He tried to make it to the pole and fell miserably short that time. And on the intervening one led by Ernst Shackleton, the three British expeditions of the first decade of the 20th century, opened an unknown continent to science and enriched our understanding of global meteorological, biological, and oceanographical systems. Together, these three expeditions, plus some others that went down at a similar time from Germany, from Sweden, from some other places, each of which of those expeditions, including the three British expeditions, wintered with over 20 men in the Antarctic, all British expeditions on Antarctica's Ross Island, proved, taken together, that the southern continents were linked together and returned with clear evidence of global climate change. Before those expeditions went, no one even knew if there was a southern continent. After they came back, they had a pretty good understanding about it. To me, not only are these stories of doing science in extreme conditions at least as gripping as those about getting to the pole, they are part of a more significant narrative that continues today in the vast amount of research still conducted in Antarctica. Further, they help us to explain why Scott trailed so far behind Amundsen despite having more men and more resources. Well, giving credit to the science of Scott's expeditions takes nothing away from Amundsen's achievement, and I don't mean to do so. Only the Norwegians reached the pole and returned safely, and they did so over an unknown route in less than 100 days with food to spare. Further, the pursuit of science does not excuse Scott for poor choices that, combined with forgivable misfortune, contributed to suffering and death on his polar journey. It does, though, provide perspective and give meaning to the British endeavor. To appreciate that point, what I want to do today, which is very different than my book. My book goes through all these expeditions and the different works and has a multitude of amazing stories to tell, stories that get lost when you only focus on the pole. But what I thought I'd do tonight, because we only have the hour, was to look back one half a year, 6 months prior to Amundsen's arrival at the pole, and just compare the accounts of those two expeditions, the Norwegian and the British. So, we'll start our story in June of 1911. Now, Scott and Amundsen at that time were at their respective winter quarters, which you can see by this map. They're about 400 miles apart on opposite ends of the Ross Ice Shelf. Now, what you've got is, of course, Antarctica. That's south. So this is the bottom of the world up here. And in the summer, this is open. Summer being January, February. This is open water. You have to get through an ice pack that's drifting out, but once you get through it, this is open water. This is the mainland coming around like this. They didn't know, but it goes like that from there. This is an ice barrier. This is an ice shelf that comes down from the glaciers. They all combine, and then they make this very thick ice shelf that's permanent with a sea edge here. This island, Ross Island, sticks out from it. Now, Scott's base is over here. This was where his earlier base was and Shackleton's earlier base when they made attempts by this route. Scott, the first time, made it about this far. Shackleton made it this far the first time. No, I guess he made it this far because there's the mark. He made it this far the first time. Shackleton made it this far the second time. And Amundsen is way over here at a cleft in the ice, the Bay of Whales, and he's going up a different route. So you can sort of follow where they are. The sun had set on both camps at that time by June. They'd actually set in late April, leaving them in midwinter darkness until September. Amundsen and his men remained in camp during this entire period, during the entire winter. They'd come down in the summer before when they could sail in, set up camp, and they spent the entire winter preparing themselves and their equipment for the polar trip ahead. They had no other ambitions, no other goals, getting ready for the trip. They set off for the pole on October 19. From that point on, with four sleds and beginning with 52 dogs, huskies, and other sled dogs, it was a dash across the Ross Ice Shelf, as you can see there, up the Axel Halberg Glacier to the Polar Plateau, which stands about 9,000 feet high, and then over it to the pole itself, arriving on December 14. The Norwegians, when they got there, saw no sign of Scott. They camped for 4 days and used every available means to confirm their position. Scanning the horizon for Scott one last time on December 17, the Norwegians started home. They left a small tent at the site. Oh, there's the Norwegians taking their sights. And there's the small tent they left with the Norwegian flag fluttering from a long pole extending from the tent's peak. Now, that's Amundsen's at the far side. Those are four of the five. Somebody has to take the picture, so there's only four in the picture. That's the tent they left. The first sentence of Amundsen's account of his return trip reads, "The going was splendid, and all were in good spirits, so we went at a great pace." Indeed, if you read the entire book, it reads about like that. It's about as gripping as that, because it was a great trip for them. The weather remained fair most of the way. Much of the route was downhill. Improvised sails were hoisted onto the sleds. Those sleds went so fast sometimes that the skiers struggled to keep up. And Amundsen was an expert cross-country skier. Rations steadily increased for men and dogs as they passed their evenly spaced supply depots. Some of this food was left behind. The polar party reached its ship back at the coast in good health and high spirits on January 25, 1924, after 99 days out and back. Amundsen had gained weight. Now, of course, the old time they're out, there's no radios, so that no one knows what's happening once you're out of communication. But he came back, he'd gained weight. Now, the story is, of course, very, very different for Scott and his men. First, looking back 6 months, that's what I was doing, going back 6 months from when they reached the pole, picking that arbitrary time, 6 months before, not all of his men were even wintering at the same place. Remember, he had a team that was four times as large as Amundsen's. Six of them, including the expedition's third officer, Victor Campbell, and geologist Raymond Priestley, a veteran of Shackleton's earlier expedition, had been dispatched to conduct scientific research on the Antarctic mainland and were wintering there as planned 100 years ago in June of 1911. Now, let me try to go back just quickly to show you where they were. That's where there they are, but I'll get to them. Scott's here. They're out here at Cape Adare on the mainland to study the mountains, interesting mountains, geology, glaciology, oceanography, the animals there doing geological research. Here they are, so you can get a picture of them, at their cabin at Cape Adare, the prefab cabin that was set up there for them. So they were there. They were no place. And these were expert. You'll hear their story. What incredible people they were. Priestley was a survivor from Shackleton's expedition, knew the area well. They were doing nothing to help the polar group. Instead, they were doing geological research. Now, when that winter ended, when that first winter ended, rather than returning to the main base on Ross Island by ship, they were instead repositioned. The ship came over, picked them up, and carried them further down the coast to a place called Terra Nova Bay, which is a geologically interesting place where three glaciers converge at the coast for a planned month of midsummer research, geological and glaciological research. For them, that's where the real adventure began. And it shows just how much of the expedition's precious resources and best men were devoted to activities other than reaching the pole. Now, Terra Nova Bay, and some of you may have been there since some have been to Antarctica. I've been there. It's a fine place for one month of geological research in the summer. I've been there for a week doing geological research, and it is a wonderful, wonderful place. But in winter, after the ship that was supposed to come and pick them up at the end of the summer and take them back to the main base, after that ship was blocked by the pack ice from retrieving them, and temperatures plunged far below zero and it became pitch dark, it became an awful place to live. But they were forced to do that because by that time it was too late to get back any other way. They're over here. The sea was open at first. Their only way was back around, and they would have to wait to the next spring. It was too late in the winter to do that, so they would have to wait to the next spring to get back. That meant surviving on their own, unplanned, without a prefabricated cabin. Well, let me just tell a little bit what they went through. The men recognized their fate in late February 1912, after wintering, waiting nearly 2 weeks at Hell's Gate, the aptly named drop-off and pick-up place. Now, Hell's Gate stands at the sea edge of a frozen basin fed by steep mountain glaciers and separated from the bay by low coastal islands and moraines. During virtually the entire winter, fierce winds from the polar plateau, 9,000 feet high, sweep down these glaciers across the bay to the sea. The men could not survive in their summer tents that they brought. And they had only brought enough food and fuel for a planned short summer stay of 6 weeks at most. As Priestley wrote in his diary at the time, it was evident that three things were absolutely necessary. We must have light, shelter, and hot food. Well, looking first for shelter, Campbell and Priestley found a large drift of packed snow on a boulder strewn coastal ridge that they named Inexpressible Island. Priestley wrote in his journal, "We first sank a trench 3 feet by 4 feet to a depth of 6 feet, and then from the side we picked out a large cave toward the thickest part of the drift. When finished, the cave, 12 feet wide by 9 feet long, and not quite tall enough for a man to stand, became the party's winter quarters for the entire winter. As Campbell wrote, our roof is hard snow, about 3 feet thick, while the walls and floors are ice." Here you can see a picture of it that they took, where they are. The men heated and cooked, because they didn't have any fuel, heated and cooked with a jerry-rigged tin stove, really a tin bucket, in which they burned seal blubber, which caked everything inside the cave, including the men, with greasy black soot. Light came from burning shoestrings in blubber lamps. To prevent the ceiling from melting, they kept the inside temperature below freezing, and when not doing chores, spent day and night in their threadbare sleeping bags. Well, with shelter and light found, such as it was, food became their preoccupation. Campbell tapped Priestley to ration the stores. And here is Priestley down in his ice hole. From the scant remaining supplies, he set aside the barest minimum for the anticipated spring trek back to main base and divided the rest by the time ahead. This allocation left each person in the group, the six of them, with only a biscuit and a mug of weak cocoa or tea per day, 12 lumps of sugar and 2 ounces of chocolate every week, and 25 raisins each month. Beyond these rations, the party lived on what it killed, which meant every seal and penguin that wandered its way that winter. There were never enough. Seal became the staple, with the meat and organs cooked into a stew they called hoosh, and the blubber fried, eaten raw, or used for fuel. Everyone found seal meat so insipidly bland that the cooks made the hoosh with seawater for added salt and raided the medicine kit for flavoring with mixed results. Now, I know some of you, San Francisco is a famous place for food. So one tip, seal, hoosh, stewed with a mustard plaster thrown into it, tastes more like linseed oil than like mustard. They were hoping for the mustard. But as Campbell, as Priestley wrote in his diary, even this was a welcome change from undiluted seal. Biscuits ended in August, sugar and chocolate in September, but seal hoosh continued even after a tainted batch caused food poisoning. Dysentery became endemic, which, as Campbell observed, I'm quoting him now, is most inconvenient in this weather, when to be out in the wind for a few seconds means frostbite. And you can guess where that frostbite was. The meat-only diet also caused a lack of bladder control. As Campbell wrote, some of us have been wetting our clothes in our sleep. One of us, even while he was awake, before he could get out the door. And these are the clothes that we have to live in for 8 months. They had no change of clothes. And of course, they couldn't wash anything, including themselves. They would just have to scrape things clean. Here's how they looked, by the way, after it was over and the light came back out. Somehow, the party survived the winter, and in spring, manhauled two sledges over two deeply crevassed ice tongues and 200 miles of often disturbed sea ice to the expedition's main base. The trip took longer than expected, 38 days in total. They frequently floundered up to the sockets of their thighs in snow, and the sledges regularly capsized on slopes. Nevertheless, on the entire way back, Priestley gathered rock specimens along the way. He was the geologist, and it was there to do geological research. These specimens, including plant fossils that they had collected, offered important evidence that Antarctica was once warm enough to sustain a rich flora. Field research on Scott's Royal Society-backed discovery expedition of 1901 and Royal Society geologist with the ensuing expedition of Ernst Shackleton in 1907 had been the first to find sense evidence of historical climate change in the Antarctic. From their observations of glacial deposits, ice-free valleys, and erratically placed glacier moraines and boulders, they had surmised that the Antarctic climate was now warming again, a hypothesis that glacial research by Priestley's men on this trip further confirmed. Its winter ordeal, however, became the party's greatest legacy. This party returned with a tale of endurance in ice, unsurpassed in the annals of British polar exploration, though totally lost in any story of getting to the pole. And it was all done not for the glory of getting to the pole, not to become famous, all done in the name of science. Here they are after they got back and were shaved, and the sledge that made it, the other sledge never made it back, but one of them they made it back with. Now, these exploits that I just went through, I just picked sort of at random. I could have told you 20 other stories from that winter of scientific research. Indeed, the one I just told you was not even the most significant diversion of resources from Scott's polar pursuit. That greatest diversion was a different story, and I'll tell that one. I'll skip some of the others, many of the others, but I'll tell one. 6 months before going to the pole, reaching the pole, that's 6 months back. If I go back that 6 months, two of the five men that would accompany Scott to the pole, Edward Wilson, and here's Edward Wilson, and HR Bertie Bowers were not even preparing for the polar journey. At least the earlier group wasn't planning to go, though they could have supported it. These people who went with Scott were not even preparing to go to the pole, but instead, 6 months before the polar trip, were on a death-defying midwinter scientific research trip. This effort exemplified the extreme lengths to which Scott's expedition went to for science. At the time, the world's greatest ornithologist, the British scientist P.L. Schlater, had postulated that penguins were the oldest surviving type of birds, and that emperors were the most ancient species of penguins. I won't go through why he thought that, but he did. At Ross Island's Cape Crozier, during Scott's earlier expedition, the explorers had been the first to discover an emperor penguin rookery. No one had ever seen one before. And Wilson, who was Slater's man on the expedition, Slater had handpicked him for the expedition as part of the science team, Wilson had determined that these remarkable birds laid and hatched their eggs in midwinter, the only bird to do anything of the sort, and Wilson discovered it. Now he wanted to go back. When he came back on the second expedition, he wanted to go back to the site, the rookery at Cape Crozier, to study these birds during the breeding season, which meant in the middle of winter. In particular, in line with then-current evolutionary theory, Wilson wanted to see if the youngest embryos of this supposed oldest avian species displayed vestiges of reptilian teeth. If Wilson could find evidence in penguin embryos linking two classes of animals, because birds have no teeth, but if he could find it in their embryos of these supposedly ancient birds, then he could confirm the hypothesis of Slater and T.H. Huxley that birds had indeed descended from reptiles. That's why he wanted to go back in the middle of winter. Now, no one had ever intentionally, no one even unintentionally, had ever tried to travel in Antarctica in the middle of winter before. Nobody had ever tried it. They would go down there and stay over the winter to prepare for a trip in the summer. Even the group trapped over on the mainland didn't try to go back in the winter. They dug an ice cave. But Wilson insisted on taking a midwinter journey to Cape Crozier from their main base. And he went with Bertie Bowers and assistant zoologist Apsley Cherry Gerard. Now, here they are setting out. Of course, it's pitch black because it's the middle of winter. It's always pitch black. There's their hut behind them. Here's their sledges. There's one in the beginning of the other that they're planning to haul. 70 miles in the middle of winter to Cape Crozier. With scientific equipment, no dogs, they're pulling them themselves. With scientific equipment, cold weather gear, and supplies loaded on 2 9-foot sledges linked end to end into the men by harnesses, the three men hauled over 750 pounds. Again, they did not use dogs. Now, the outward bound part of the journey went about as well as you could expect. Here they are. Here's their main base. Here's the island. It's sticking out of the ice shelf. There's the edge of the ice shelf. In the summer, this is open, not open then. They're going to come around below it, because you can't go over the mountains. They're going to come around below it, over the ice shelf, and up to Cape Crozier at the other, far other end of the island. Well, as you can see, the men traveled south to Cape Armitage, and from there they went up onto the Ross Ice Shelf. Then it got cold, colder than had ever previously been recorded anywhere on Earth. As they traveled the south side of Ross Island from Cape Armitage to Cape Crozier, below minus 75 degrees Fahrenheit. The granular snow caused by this extreme cold created sand-like surface. The crystals of snow become just like sand. And so the surface becomes not like pulling a sledge over ice or over nice snow like you're skiing. No, it becomes like pulling it over a sandy beach. And you can imagine what a 750-pound sledge on runners would do. It sinks into the sand. And that made it so tough to pull that they couldn't pull two at once. So that means they'd have to relay. They'd pull one, then they'd have to go back and get the other and then go again, which means 1 mile gain for 3 miles walked. Finally, on July 15th, nearly 3 weeks after they began, the men climbed onto a windswept, rocky moraine overlooking Cape Crozier. Somewhere below them, on the sea ice, about 4 miles to the east, shrouded in darkness, lay the rookery. Nobody had seen it in winter before. They'd been there in the spring or late fall or early spring. Well, before trying to reach it, though, they haven't even done the worst yet. Before trying to reach it, the men built a stone hut on the moraine where they planned to live and work while studying the penguins. Why would they do that? Well, because to do this delicate embryo research, they couldn't let the eggs freeze, because once the eggs froze, the embryos wouldn't be able to see the detail. So they would have to get the eggs, the plan was, and bring them back to someplace warm, above freezing, and then dissect them and open them up, and then do careful, you know, they had microscopes and they had the tools. They had to study them. So they had to build a hut, which would be warm to above freezing. It took them 3 days. Using a sledge as a ceiling beam, they stretched canvas over the top of four rock walls that they gathered, caulked the cracks with snow, and assembled a blubber stove for heat. To protect it from a storm sweeping off the ice shelf, they built the hut into the side of the moraine, just below the ridge, because then they figured the wind would go over the top of them, because they thought the wind would be coming down. Wilson thought the wind would be coming down from the mountains to the ice shelf. With the hut up and a need for blubber for fuel, the party set out for the penguins. Well, making full use of the midday twilight that now dimly illumined the ice for a few hours every day, the sun never came up, but there was a little twilight by this time, the men tried twice to reach the rookery. The first time, they dropped into the sea ice beyond the first pressure ridge and spent 5 hours wandering amid a labyrinth of 60-foot-high ice hummocks before retreating to the hut in darkness, in total frustration. They could hear the penguins, but they were walking between this maze of these turned-up ice, and they never got to them. The next day, instead, they made a steep descent to a narrow gorge between the first pressure ridge and the land ice cliff, which they followed toward the rookery. They encountered obstacles where debris pushed in from the ice shelf or fallen from the cliff, but they either crawled through holes in this ice or cut steps in it to climb over it, and finally reached the rookery just before it got dark. Well, now they faced a dilemma. As Cherry Gerard wrote in his book about it, "After indescribable effort and hardship, we were witnessing a marvel of the natural world. We had within our grasp material which might prove of utmost importance to science. We were turning theories into facts with every observation we made, but we had but a moment to give. It was getting dark. They hadn't carried supplies to stay out. They didn't have a tent, nor could they get back on this route in darkness. So what they did for that first day was they quickly skinned 3 penguins for blubber, grabbed 6 eggs, and bolted for the hut with the expectation of returning another day for further research." Here is how the rookery looked. They couldn't take a picture because it was dark, but Wilson drew a picture of what they saw. Here's the rookery, and here's the 3 eggs that finally made it back. You can see them in England in the British Museum. Now, unfortunately, the weather deteriorated overnight after they got back and threatened to become much worse. By situating the hut just below the ridge, Wilson had hoped to protect it from winds coming down. But instead, he had placed it in the path of powerful updrafts going up off the sea ice. The storm's first strong gust, you guessed it, ballooned the canvas roof upward and sucked snow in from every crack. The men piled slabs of ice on the roof during a lull in the storm, but it made little difference. The brunt of the storm hit the following night with gale force winds, causing the hut's roof to rise and fall with growing violence until finally, about noon on the third day, it exploded outward in shreds, leaving the men cowering in their sleeping bags under drifting snow and rubble from the roof and the walls. It was Wilson's 39th birthday. 70 miles from winter quarters, without shelter, Cherry Girard lost all hope and began about thinking about taking morphine to ease the end. The storm subsided a day later, however, and they headed back to the main base. The eggs they collected, of course, had all now either been lost or frozen, rendering them useless for embryo research. There was no possibility of doing further work. The return trip was a living hell. The exhausted party first had to recross the pressure ridges and crevassed land ice around Cape Crozier, then pass over the frigid ice shelf to Cape Armitage, before turning north on the sea ice to winter quarters. With only about 4 hours of dim twilight and up to 16 hours of sledging each day, darkness remained a severe handicap. As Wilson wrote, "We traveled as much by ear and by the feel of the snow and ice underfoot as by sight. At one point, Bowers dropped into a seemingly bottomless crevasse and hung there by a sledging harness out of sight until he was rescued by Wilson on a rope." Now, this is Wilson's drawing of that. That's the one advantage of pulling your own sledge in a harness. If you do fall into a crevasse, you're held up by the harness. And Wilson comes down, because it would have gone down for forever. Now, there's Wilson coming down. Now, this, of course, that's a help if the sledge doesn't follow you down. And, of course, Cherry Girard is hanging on for dear life to keep the sledge from following him down. And that's the drawing of it. Well, temperatures again plunged toward minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit below zero, making the sleeping bags worthless for warmth. So that they could get into them at night, the men let their bags freeze open every morning and laid them flat on the sledge, because what happens at night is you sweat. And so water goes into the bag, and then it freezes. So if you roll up the sleeping bag, you can never unroll it. So what they would do is they'd lay them flat and stuff them with clothes and let them freeze open and then pull the clothes out and slide themselves in at night. By the end of the trip, each 17-pound bag had accumulated up to 27 pounds of ice. Cherry Girard complained of uncontrollable shivering and recurrent nightmares whenever he tried to sleep. He wrote, "The worst job was to get into the bags. The second worst, or equal, was to lie in them for 6 hours. No one got much sleep." Bowers and Cherry Girard became so exhausted they literally fell asleep while pulling their sledges. Cherry Girard's jaws chattered so much that all of his teeth shattered. In his book about the expedition, Cherry Girard described the Crozier trip as, quote, "the worst journey in the world." The return trip took 8 days, and the entire journey lasted over 5 weeks. Other members of the expedition gasped when they saw how the Crozier party appeared on its return and shuddered when they heard the traveler's tale. Surveying all three men, and here they are back getting their first warm cup of cocoa, Scott commented, "They look more weather-worn than anyone I have ever seen. Their faces were scarred and wrinkled, their eyes dull, their hands whitened and creased with constant exposure to damp and cold." Yet, 2 months later, still weakened from this ordeal, Wilson and Bowers set off with Scott for the pole. Cherry Girard would have been along, but he never really recovered. These two extreme efforts were only the most dramatic distractions from this expedition's focus on reaching the pole. Whenever in residence in winter quarters, all the officers and scientists participated in a rigorous regimen of meteorological, magnetic, and oceanographical research with the data collected on a daily and, in some cases, hourly basis. Here's Wilson and Bowers taking some meteorological readings in the middle of the night, of course, because it's always the middle of the night. During that time of year. The team's marine biologist regularly cut holes in the 6-foot-thick sea ice to dredge for marine specimens. A physicist studied ice and snow crystals. 2 geologists and 1 glaciologist stationed at winter quarters led an extended, led an extended 6-man journey into the dry valleys, rugged peaks, and enormous glaciers of the transantarctic mountains during the expedition's first summer. They spent the winter, rather than helping prepare for the polar trip, this group spent the winter examining their collections before heading out on a similar journey for the second summer. Here they are, busy working in the winter. Their second journey coincided with Scott's polar trek, drawing off men and resources. Further, during the first of these journeys, they had set stakes across Farrar Glacier over on the mainland as markers to gauge the movement of the glacier. But it only works if you go back and check how much they move. So in September of 1911, less than a month before the beginning of his planned departure for the pole, Scott took Bertie Bowers, just back from the winter journey with Wilson, meteorologist George Simpson, and Edgar Evans, who would go on the polar journey, on a sledge trip to see if these stakes had moved. And here they are heading out. There's Scott and Bowers in front, pulling their sledge, of course. They didn't take dogs. They pulled them, because that's the British way. They pull the sledges themselves. Now, in his diary, Scott characterized this two-week trip as a useful warm-up to the polar journey. But his harshest critic, historian Roland Huntford, later condemned it. Scott went 150 miles in a senseless direction, Huntford wrote. It would have been better to move fresh seal meat along to the road to the south. Certainly, Huntford's criticism has merit. The trip was an ordeal. It included man-hauling a sledge in minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit and a forced march of 35 miles in one 24-hour period. Yet, Scott saw it very differently. 2 days before departing on this trip, after reviewing the expedition's scientific work so far and all but conceding that Amundsen, because he would travel lighter and faster, would win the race to the pole, Scott wrote in his diary, quote, "It is really a satisfactory state of affairs all around. If the polar journey," and here is Scott writing in his diary, "if the polar journey comes off, that is, if I make it to the pole and back alive, nothing, not even lost priority at the pole, not even Amundsen getting there first," he's writing, "can prevent my expedition ranking as the most important that ever entered the polar regions, north or south. Science would make it so, and thus science must be served." Well, scarcely a month after returning from this trek, and by then 10 days behind Amundsen and leaving, Scott headed south across the Ross Ice Shelf, up Beardmore Glacier, and over the polar plateau with teams of men, ponies, tractors, and dogs. Unlike Amundsen, who traveled light and with only those who would go the entire distance, Scott planned to have the various supporting teams drop back in stages, first the tractors, then the ponies, then the dogs, with their handlers, leaving only one group to man-haul a single sledge across the 9,000-foot-high polar plateau to the pole itself. In the end, this group consisted of Scott, Wilson, Bowers, Evans, who we've all met, and also British Army Captain Lawrence Titus Oates. So just to finish off, and here they are, sledging. Of course, one person has to take the picture, but there they are, sledging toward the pole. Now let's pick up the story as they approach the pole and end it there. I have time for questions. On January 16, that's 100 years ago yesterday, on January 16, less than 20 miles from the pole, they sighted debris left by the Norwegians. "This told the whole story," Scott wrote. "It is a terrible disappointment, and I'm very sorry for my loyal companions." Those companions, however, took comfort in what they'd done. Bowers wrote in his diary at this point, "It is sad that we have been forestalled by the Norwegians, but I'm glad we've done it by good British man-hauling." For Wilson, the solace came in science. "While the Norwegians had won the race," he wrote in his diary, "we have done what we came to do all the same as our scientific program was made out." Now, the British team found the small tent that Amundsen had left, and there they are at the tent, the Norwegians' tent, took several rounds of sight to confirm their locations and departed a day later. On the return trip, the surface posed the most relentless problems, with extreme cold producing the same sand-like surface that Wilson had encountered the winter before. Now, Amundsen had gotten back earlier, and the snow had not turned like this, but it turned cold. It was much the same day after day, if you read the sledger's diary, all filled with complaints about the snow. "All pole, no glide," with the sledge runners sometimes sinking so deep in the granular surface that the crossbars plowed through the snow. One expects the Antarctic to be cold, even in summer, but it had turned colder than normal, and as it had became later in the season, much colder than Amundsen had faced. Hunger stalked the polar party, too, even though it traveled with full rations. Until near the journey's end, they reached most depots with food to spare. But the prescribed amount for each meal did not supply enough calories for pulling at altitude over poor surfaces at low temperatures. Then the fuel began running low due to leakage in the stores left in the depots, which meant cold pemmican rather than warm hoosh. You can sort of get an idea for how they were feeling. This is a picture taken at the pole. They got all five in because you can see that Bowers is pulling a string there. But you can sort of see how much more beat they look than Amundsen's men at the pole. But now going back, well, the unrelented heavy sledding, low temperatures, and inadequate diet invariably weakened everyone. For Evans, the serious troubles began when he gashed his hand on December 31st. The wound became infected, and his fingers suffered severe and prolonged frostbite. He lost three or four fingernails. By the time that the polar party reached the Beardmore Glacier on the way back down, remember, they go over the plateau, down the Beardmore Glacier, and then across the Ross Ice Shelf. By the time they reached the Beardmore Glaciers and headed down, Wilson wrote it, quote, Evans' fingers discharging pus, nose very bad and looking rotten. By then, Oates' feet had also reached a critical stage. Titus's toes are black, Wilson reported, and his nose and cheeks are dead yellow. Now, this is when he wrote it. They were coming down, this picture I took, coming down the Beardmore Glacier from the polar plateau up here. And what you see is, from the, where I took the picture, is that black mountain. Everything else is white. When they got to Black Mountain, despite the conditions I just described, everyone is lack of food, severe medical problems. When they reached that Mount Buckley, they took time out for geology. Deep snow and ice covered most of the route, return route from the pole. With the mountains above Beardmore, these mountains providing the only relief from the solid white and ice. Upon reaching the glacier, the nearly exhausted sledgers steered toward a moraine, a rock moraine, below Mount Buckley to do research. They couldn't have done anything anywhere else on geology because you couldn't get to the rocks. Here you could. Now, this is what I saw looking down. Here is their picture of it from the side going down. This is their picture of what they saw. Scott wrote, the moraine was obviously so interesting that I decided to camp and spend a couple days geologizing. We found ourselves under a perpendicular cliff of Beacon sandstone weathering rapidly, carrying variable coal seams. From this last, Wilson, with his sharp eyes, has picked out several plant impressions. That's plant fossils. Now, this is Wilson's drawing of the same thing. He drew everything so he could mark where he took all the rocks. So this is his last drawing he ever made. This is his drawing of these rocks. Those impressions, plant impressions, included some from the distinctive Paleolithic era flora called Glossopteris, which geologists on all three British Antarctic expeditions had been seeking. The flora was known in the fossil record of South America, Africa, and Australia. But biologists were stymied how it could get to those three desperate places unless it had evolved first in a central Antarctic continent when it was warmer and then moved north as the global climate cooled. By proving that the southern continents were linked, finding Glossopteris could help salvage meaning from a failed attempt to reach the pole first. Well, this break gave the party its last respite. They ended up collecting 35 pounds of rocks, put them on the sledge and bringing them back. Now, Evans was the first to go. After floundering down the glacier after this stop for research for a week and falling into several crevasses, he became increasingly disorientated. Wilson thought that Evans had injured his brain in a fall, and by February 16th, described him as, quote, sick, giddy, and unable to walk even by the sledge on skis. He dropped far behind the others a day later, and when they went back for them, he was on his knees with his gloves off and a wild look in his eyes. By the time they carried him back to the tent, he had slipped into a coma and soon died. Leaving the body, they proceeded down the glacier and onto the ice shelf. Now, Oates was the next to go. His feet kept getting worse. The cold and the lack of fuel for hot meals contributed to the problem. By the ice shelf's midpoint, he could no longer pull and harness, and soon began holding the party back, which irked the soldier in him. On March 11, Scott ordered Wilson to supply everyone with a fatal dose of opium, but Oates struggled on with the others for 5 more days. Scott wrote on the 17th in his diary, "Oates slept through the night before last, hoping not to wake, but he awoke in the morning. It was blowing a blizzard. He said, 'I am just going outside and maybe sometime.' He went out into the blizzard, and we have not seen him since." March 17 was Oates' 32nd birthday. The others marched their last on March 19. 2 days earlier, they had left behind everything except the barest essentials and, at Wilson's requests, their diaries, scientific field notes, and the 35 pounds of geological specimens. These they carried to the end. Their final camp stood only 11 miles shy of a massive depot stocked with special treats, where a relief party had waited until the 10th. Scott's right foot had given out, and their fuel was nearly gone, but they retained some hope of getting through. They knew their approximate location. Then a blizzard struck. It lasted at least 8 days, or so Scott's diary states. By then, they had eaten all of their remaining food. Some historians have suggested that the blizzard must have ended earlier, but either Wilson or Bowers would not leave Scott, or Scott held them back. In any event, they died together, with Wilson and Bowers in an attitude of sleep, and Scott between them, his sleeping bag half open, and an arm flung across Wilson. The following spring, a search party found them frozen in this position, along with their notes and 35 pounds of geological specimens. Here's a picture of them in the tent, taken earlier, of course. Lots of us know something about Amundsen Scott and their expeditions to the South Pole. It's an epic tale that has become part of our common knowledge. But as much of our common knowledge, it is somewhat mythologized. From my experience, here's what I think most people believe. Amundsen and his Norwegian team arrived at the pole first after an amazing dash by dog sled. Scott's group reached it 5 weeks later, exhausted from having man-hauled their sledges much of the way. Scott, for some reason few people fully understand, wanted men to pull and did not want dogs to suffer. Because the two teams reached the pole so close together, people naturally view it as a race, some sort of exotic international Olympiad. Amundsen then rushes back to his base in a stunning exhibition of Scandinavian efficiency. Disappointed in defeat, Scott's men trudge north in worsening weather on waning supplies, succumbing in a snowstorm only miles from their main supply depot. Over time and countless retellings, Amundsen becomes a model of modern organization, not necessarily loved, but certainly respected. While Scott becomes a heroic but tragic Victorian blunderer, derided by some for poor planning and choices, but idolized by others for his perseverance in the face of death. The common knowledge is about right on Amundsen, but is sorely deficient on Scott. Of the two expeditions, Scott's was actually the more modern in its conception and a marvel of planning, if not execution. With 33 men wintering in the Antarctic compared to Amundsen's 9, Scott led a complex and multifaceted expedition while Amundsen staked everything on the pole. Further, the common knowledge ignores Scott's final expedition was the third in a series of 3 major British Antarctic expeditions that built directly on a much longer history of Royal Navy voyages of scientific exploration and discovery in the Southern Ocean, dating back to the days of James Cook and James Clark Ross. Initially a secondary and unspoken ambition of these efforts, becoming first at the South Pole gradually became a British obsession, but one only to be achieved in the course of conducting a proper scientific research expedition. Doubtless, Scott wrote, capturing this whole sense, he wrote of his final expedition before he left, "Doubtless there are those who will criticize this provision for scientific research in view of our published objective of reaching the pole. But I believe that the more intelligent section of the community will heartily approve of an endeavor to achieve the greatest possible scientific harvest which the circumstances permit. The British explorers and their sponsors would never admit to being engaged in a mere dash to the pole. Amundsen had no such inhibitions. He won the race, at least in part, because Scott was handicapped by scientific aims. But in the course of losing that race, researchers on the British expedition helped to open an unknown continent for science. Thank you.
Our thanks to Ed for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Scott Amundsen and Science, the 100th anniversary of Robert Falcon Scott reaching the South Pole, with Ed Larson. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. We have two standing microphones. If you have questions, please line up behind the microphones and speak into the microphones. Any questions?
And I know some people have to leave.
Yeah, no problem. If you need to leave, please.
But I was told to finish at 7, and I heard the beep, right, as I said.
We'll take maybe a couple questions if you have a few questions. We'll take a few questions.
And you can ask about Shackleton, too. You're not limited to this. I'm a big Shackleton fan.
You're a lawyer, right?
I am a historian and a lawyer.
Yeah. So. Were there any moral ways of balancing the value of science and life? And did they have any idea about that?
Well, the question was, yeah, were there any moral ways? Well, of course, Scott didn't intend to die. He didn't think he was dooming his men. He deeply believed, he was sent down on the first expedition, was funded by the British government as a scientific research expedition solely. It was designed by the Royal Society, the world's foremost scientific society at the time, and the Royal Geographic Society. They were supposed to do mapping and scientific research. But Scott was not a scientist. Scott was the naval captain who was supposed to ferry the scientists down. So he was free during the summer of scientific research. And so his plan all along was to, with Shackleton on the first expedition and others, go to the pole, because he wasn't needed for the science. So he was, in a way, a ferry boat captain. He was ferrying people down. And that so, and these teams were off doing science. None of the scientists really died. They certainly faced ordeals. But I don't think that Scott never viewed him. He thought he had planned his trip to the pole for safety. That's the ironic thing. He had. It was a slow route with horses and dogs and tractors, the first tractors. He sort of helped develop the first tractors. He thought it would be safer. He certainly didn't expect to die. But on the other hand, you must say of Scott, on all of his own treks, and he did many trips on both. He of course, made that one over study, the moving stakes. But the first winter, he went south, tried to make it to the pole, and he also made a trip up to the polar plateau and went across there to try to reach the other side of the polar plateau. He took other trips. His trips were always death-defying events. It was characteristic of Scott, because Scott was a storyteller. Scott wrote these accounts up. There's a long history of British expeditions, of death-defying expeditions, going back to the days of John Franklin going to the, and you know, the man who ate his boots, who was knighted for, you know, his trek out of trying to find the Northwest Passage. First time he made it out, the second time, of course, with the ships Erebus and Terror, he never made it back. And they would write up their stories, and they'd become bestsellers, sort of like David Livingston did. Other explorers, Speakes and Burton, they all wrote it. And part of the thing was, it had to be a thrilling story, and they would become bestsellers. And so Scott always was cutting everything to the edge. Of course, it only works if you make it back and write the whole story. Now, we do have the story of Scott's second expedition because, you know, he had pre-sold the book rights, the magazine rights, and the newspaper rights, in every country. I mean, all this had been pre-sold. He had to deliver them. And you had to deliver the story fast because the news is short-lived. So he was writing all these things as he went. And so when they found the dead bodies, you know, most of the book was back in the before they left, but all the part about going down and back, that was all finished. He had written it as they were going because, it, you know, they had to get it out fast. And so to get the book that we now have of the trip, they literally had to break his frozen arm because it was frozen. It was frozen, but they knew they had to get it back because that was his, you know, legacy for his own trip and, of course, the for his son and his wife. So they had to break his arm to get the book out. But they were writing it in a way. And if and the problem with Amundsen's book is that Amundsen made it too easy. It wasn't a great story. And you read Amundsen's book, and it's not that thrilling. It looked like, well, I could do that. I sort of think of the difference of baseball, watching films of Joe DiMaggio, who made every catch look easy, and Willie Mays of San Francisco, who made every catch look hard. And but he made them, but he made it look hard, and Wilson and Scott tried to make things look hard. So it really wasn't a legal thing of science, because it wasn't the science ones that were these trips. But boy, the scientists had some adventures, as I read about in the books. Yes, sir.
Having hiked part of Shackleton's trip across South Georgia, I, like you, admire him greatly. And I just like two questions. One, how do you rank Shackleton among the three in terms of skill and attention to safety and so forth? And the second question is, why in the world did Scott not use dogs?
Okay, well, let me deal with both. As I say, I'm a great admirer of Shackleton. My book has enormous numbers of Shackleton stories because most people don't write about Shackleton's Nimrod expedition, where he fell only 100 miles short of reaching the pole in an amazing polar journey that went up the polar plateau and across the polar plateau. He fell just short. He took scientists along and was a very successful expedition. But he, too, was a great... He was actually a better storyteller. He was an amazing storyteller than Scott, and a great writer. And his story of that first expedition was a bestseller, as was the story of the one where his ship was crushed and he had to sail across. Shackleton, they were... edge of the seat thrilling, which meant they were edge of the seat daring and death defying, but he never lost a man. Scott always lost men. Men died on both of his expeditions, including himself, of course, on the second one. Amundsen always made everything look safe and easy, and the one around the Northwest Passage, as well as the one going to the South Pole. So how do you compare the men? Well, when I read the accounts of the men who were along with him, everybody loved being with Shackleton. He had an amazingly magnetic personality. And as a result, he had better scientists than Scott. Scientists lined up. Members of the Royal Society, which is the highest accolade, 50-year-old scientists went with him. They loved being with Shackleton. People loved Shackleton. People didn't love Amundsen. They viewed Amundsen as cold and very efficient, but not... Scott's men generally didn't like him. Very few... Wilson liked him, but very few people liked him. Of course, Shackleton, who was on his first expedition, hated him. And most of his men hated him. Now, they respected him in the sense that Scott never made any of them do anything worse than he did himself. He would put himself through it, but they thought he was a poor planner and made a lot of mistakes. So how would you compare the two? If I actually wanted to get to the pole, my 50s. If I wanted to get to the pole and back, I'd go with Amundsen. If I wanted to have a good time that I'd never forget and survive, I'd go with Shackleton. And I wouldn't go with Scott. And why they use dogs, it's a complex combination of why they wouldn't use dogs. It's a bunch of things that fit together. There's no easy answer to that. First, there's simply that British view dogs as pets, not as beasts of burden. And they don't like them to suffer, and that was part of it. Part of it was the sense that went back to Clements Markman, who was the one who handpicked Scott for the first expedition. Scott had no intention of being a polar explorer, but the head of the Royal Geographic Society, Clements Markman, handpicked Scott because he thought he was intrepid and was a variety of reasons I won't go into. The book goes into them at greater length. But Clements Markman, who had been on the Franklin searches in the 1850s, 60s, old man by this time, had gone, he was part of the Navy earlier, had been enthralled by this notion of camaraderie built by man-hauling together. And he wanted to build, he viewed these expeditions in part to toughen the Navy during times of peacetime. And so the camaraderie that would be built by man-hauling, he believed in. Then you add to that the sense that if you're trying to get to the pole, it's cheating if you fly there. It's cheating if you get, you're cheating if you get a drive there. You've got to, if you're getting to the top of Everest, which was a goal at the same time, you got to climb it yourself. And so in that same sense, if you really want to get to the pole, you got to walk there yourself. And then the final reason, as I say, there are multiple reasons, is Scott did take dogs on the first trip, on the Discovery expedition. But they were an utter failure. The trouble is, you have to know how to mush dogs. It's very tricky. And you have to train them. And the British didn't know how to mush dogs. And on the first trip, it was a disaster. You could see pictures of them. They tried to pull with the dogs. And dogs will not pull with people. They will not. They'll let the people do the work. They won't pull with people. And it was a mess. And Scott didn't trust dogs. Amundsen had learned how to mush dogs during those 3 years in the Canadian Arctic as he was sailing across the Northwest Passage and wintering. He became an expert dog musher. So he knew dogs. Scott didn't know them. And if you don't know how they work, you're better off with ponies, which is what Shackleton took. Shackleton went, almost made it to the pole with ponies. Another question.
Sure. I think Empire of Nice did a really exceptional job of explaining the scientific aspects, I think, that have been underrepresented. But a surprising secondary thing is I think that you did an exceptional job of actually describing Amundsen and his character. That was surprising to me. I've read a lot of works on it, but I think... he's a secondary character, but I think you nailed him exactly. One slight comment. I think you slight Amundsen just a little bit when it comes to scientific matters. You have to remember that Amundsen was on the first scientific group that overwintered in Antarctica 3 years before right. Scott. Second, when he crossed the Northwest Passage, he actually studied in preparing for it for 3 months with Neumayer in Hamburg, partially because the British wouldn't let him study in England. Mm-hmm. And so when he crossed the Northwest Passage, he was able to go to the exact spot that Ross went to earlier and was able to physically prove that the magnetic pole moved. And even on the last trip, with the Fram, when he changed direction, he was fully filled with scientific instruments to study the Arctic Ocean. Right. But, of course, in Antarctica, none of that equipment made any sense. So right. Just a small critique, but I still want to compliment you that you did a superb job in profiling Amundsen in this book.
Well, thank you very much, and I think you're absolutely right. And I do talk about those things in the book. Amundsen is the first to say... I mean, Amundsen did serious scientific research on the Northwest Passage. The original plan was for the expedition that he got to the South Pole was not to go to the South Pole. It was to go to the North Pole and freeze the ship in above Nome and be carried by the currents across the North Pole and therefore become the first to the North Pole. And during that, he would have done scientific research. Nansen had prepared him for it, and of course, you're right, he'd studied magnetic in Germany. What had happened was, of course, was that Perry then claimed to get to the North Pole. He never really did, but he claimed to get to the North Pole. And Amundsen was never, as you point out, was never going to get anywhere second. He was determined to do something to make a difference. He was a very proud man. And he was going to get to the South Pole. So he, rather than go north, he didn't tell his men when they left. He didn't tell anyone. He didn't tell the king. He didn't tell the people who'd funded it. He sailed south to the South Pole. And only when he got to the last landfall, an island, when he couldn't be turned back because there were no radios, he told his men, you can get off if you want, but we're going to the South Pole. But he wrote, to explain myself, he himself wrote that on this, quote, little detour, as he wrote it, on this little detour, science would have to take care of itself. I'm not going to do any science on this detour. I would do science with the North. And so there was no science on going to the South Pole. But absolutely, if he had done the polar drift, and when he was doing the others, he was doing science, and he was not only an expert at magnetism, which Scott was not. Scott took scientists along, but was not a scientist himself. He was also an expert at navigation and celestial. So he could determine, and so were three of those five. Three of the five were experts, and people often ask me, how do they know they're at the South Pole? There's no pole there. There wasn't then. You do it by taking sights. And the reason why he stayed 4 days is he took sights and then he kept moving a little bit till he narrowed it down to about a football field sized area that it had to be in. And then he had his men walk back and forth over that football fight so one of them would have stepped in it. Now, Scott could never have done that. He had nobody in the group, no one who could take polar navigation of that. The only reason he knew he got to the South Pole was there was a Norwegian flag there. Next question.
Okay, this is just a quick comment, but if you go to Britain, I went to Britain and talked to people, and Scott's a hero. Went to Norway, Amundsen is not a hero. They thought he was stuffy. They don't, you know, I was really surprised at that. Nansen's the hero there.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a very, very good point. Amundsen is viewed as a cold and stuffy, and Nansen is a national hero. Nansen was the precursor for Amundsen's hero. Amundsen wanted to be great, and as a child, Nansen had gone across Greenland on skis, and Amundsen wanted that glory, and that's when he decided he was going to become a polar explorer. Then Nansen tried to make it to the North Pole by a drift expedition, didn't quite make it. Incredible story. And so Amundsen was going to repeat that. So you're right. But then Nansen has a lot more. Nansen was a great scientist. He ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in Europe. Of course, it's a little easier for a Norwegian to win the Nobel Peace Prize. It's sort of an inside track. They give it to themselves a little bit. But still, he is a national hero. And the view of Amundsen, it's changing a little bit. There's a couple new biographies, and of course there's some erotic new pictures of Nansen out on the online if you want to see them. He in his very old age, he fell in love with a woman from San Francisco, I think it was. Some American. Maybe it was from New York. And she had to go back. And so in his 70s or 80s, he took nude pictures of himself, which have recently been discovered and now are all available online, that he sent to her, saying, look what you're missing. He did look pretty good for 78. Anyway.
We'll take one last question if you have any questions.
Okay, good question. It says, darkness, how do you know where you're going to go? Well, that would certainly be true for Wilson's group. Of course, because there's no darkness in the winter, there is nothing but light in the summer. When I went down for 3 months, I told my wife, it's not too bad. I'm not even going on for a day. It'll never be dark. The sun never sets. So when they're going to the South Pole, it's never dark. It's light 24 hours a day, and the sun is literally going in a circle, and you know you're in the middle of the South Pole when this pole circle is right exact around you, and you take these measurements. How they find where they are is you're right, they have to navigate. And when they're up in the polar plateau or when they're on the Ross ice shelf, it's nothing but white. So how do you find out where you are? And what you do is you've always got the sun up, and you take you plot where the sun is, and you use the plotting of where the sun is and time. You can use time and the sun, and you use a chronometer, and you have these other devices that by plotting the location of the sun, you can plot ultimately your longitude and your latitude. And they would be keeping these records. As long as you have your time, you can do these things. Now, it doesn't work without a time, but you use a combination of these devices, and they had the tools to basically plot their longitude and latitude. And basically, Scott could do it. Scott just could do it in a rough sense. He was a navigator, on the ship before. But what he couldn't do the precision with which Amundsen could to find the precise North Pole. But you can find your general location. You're pretty close. And they would map it. And they would also use plane tables. One of those pictures was a plane table where they would plot the mountains, and then they could follow the mountains, and they would triangulate the mountains and then be making very precise maps. They came back with amazing maps, unlike Amundsen. Amundsen didn't even know where the mountains were. I mean, he had gone on a new route, new mountains no one had ever seen. He named some of them. Nobody knows to this day which mountains he named because he was going so fast that he didn't even keep where the Scott's party had very precise maps of the locations. But Amundsen, when he got to the pole, was serious. And there he figured that out. But how you do it is just plotting the sun. Everything is based on the sun. There are no stars. At night, of course, you can use stars, but that's not how Wilson did it. The only person who ever tried to travel it in the winter, in darkness, was Wilson. And here, all he did was just follow he just kept the island on his right going out and left going back, and you could do that. So, yes. Oh, that's the last one. Oh, he was incredible. We do know. I mean, the pole was within that square. And the square is about a football field large. Finally, after 4 days of narrowing it, they thought it was one place. They moved a few miles. They kept moving. And they had it within a football field. So, no, he did an excellent job. It was within that square. Thank you.
Our thanks to Ed for his comments here today, and we also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating the 108th year of enlightened discussions is adjourned.